You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
Monster House presents
Monster Talks, a proud member of the Airwave Media Podcast Network, home of such shows as Kick-Ass News, Movie Therapy, and Therapist Uncensored. If you'd like to advertise on this show, contact sales at advertisecast.com.
Are you okay?
I feel funny.
Have you noticed anything odd with him?
It says Dybbuk. It's the Hebrew word for demon.
What does this thing want with my daughter?
The spirit is the taker of children.
We're all here for you.
Once the box is open,
people die.
I saw something in her.
Her possession. Rated PG-13.
It's actually quite unlike anything we've ever seen before.
A giant, hairy creature, part ape, part man.
In Loch Ness, a 24-mile-long bottomless lake in the highlands of Scotland, it's a creature known as the Loch Ness Monster.
Monster Talk. Welcome to Monster Talk, the science show about monsters. I'm Blake Smith.
And I'm Karen Stolzner.
This week's episode is another from our YouTube series, based on a true story. We'll be taking a look at the film The Possession, a 2012 production directed by Ole Bornedal and produced by Sam Raimi and Robert Tappert, among others. I'm a longtime fan of Raimi's direction, and his work with Robert Tappert produced things like the Evil Dead series and the TV shows Hercules and Xena. But this film is ripped from the headlines based on the story told by Kevin Manis, who said that he bought a wine cabinet in 2001 that turned out to be a container for a Dybbuk, an evil spirit from Jewish folklore. Was it a true story? Stay tuned and find out, but be advised that this episode has many spoilers for the film The Possession. So if you prefer to see your movies before having them deconstructed, you might want to pause here and go find somewhere cozy to watch the film. A link to the movie, along with some articles about the film's subject matter, are in the show notes.
Monster Talk.
Welcome, everyone, to another episode of the Based on a True Story. I'm Matthew Baxter.
Hi, everyone. I'm Karen Stolzner.
And shalom. I'm Blake Smith.
So just a little hint at what we're going to be discussing today.
That's right.
The Possession. The Possession. But I think a lot of people know this movie as The Dybbuk Box rather
it is,
than The
it
Possession.
Is, it is The Dybbuk Box movie. It is.
Yeah. But yes, there exactly. is actually a Dybbuk Box movie as well. So we have to be careful.
Oh, yeah.
Is that one also based on a true story?
I'm sure it's probably.
Is this one?
Is the yeah? That's
wow.
Very very well asked there, Karen.
I enjoyed the film. I think in and
really?
Of itself, yeah, I think it's a fun film, and it has shades of other movies like The Exorcist, which we'll get into shortly. But yeah, I think it's a fun film. But when taken into consideration with the backstory. Maybe not so fun.
I felt like it was an easy bake oven, too much, too formulaic. Like, but
very pretty. And I like seeing Jeffrey Dean Morgan in almost anything. And, you know, his in his background, he was actually going to be a professional basketball player. That was his goal. And he got an injury and didn't get to do that. So it was cool.
He was the like, coach in this.
Exactly. So he gets to bring those basketball skills back to play. So when he was shooting in that scene, probably really shooting.
Yeah. So that was based on true events.
That part was true.
The only part. Well, okay.
All right. Well, thank you, everyone, for joining us. Next week. I thought it was a fun movie. And Blake and I had talked very briefly before the show about how when you look at the other movies that came out around the same time, this was one of the better movies. It really was. And it has a lot of bad about it. Even setting aside the whole this is a true story, but you know, there's a plot hole here and there that we'll probably have to examine. But the movie kind of starts out. When did this come out? 2012,
I believe. I think so. Yeah.
Okay. So the movie starts out with this older woman standing in what appears to be her living room, lounge room. Staring at this box sitting on the mantle. Mm-hmm. And it's like she's having some sort of communication with it, but not a happy communication. She seems to be very upset about it. Mm-hmm. And then she decides, that's it. You're evicted. And went to, what'd she go get a hammer, I believe?
Yeah. She went and got a ball-peen hammer. She's going to smash it. Yeah.
Yeah. And it did not go well.
I thought that was probably a metaphor for the control that television has over us all. It talks to us, but we can't talk back, and you want to just smash it with a hammer.
And you have to shoot it like Elvis. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, no, I thought agree that completely. That was such a violent scene. I had seen this movie, I guess, around the time that it came out. And I've forgotten a lot of it.
Sorry. Oh, really? Really? You saw it in the theaters?
Oh, no. I guess when it came out, you know, for
streaming video, whatever
format it came out on. And but I'd forgotten a lot of the plot. And so to watch that scene again, I thought, wow, that was just so violent. And I think that should have killed her, the way that it thrust her back against the wall and threw her against the coffee table and her head smacked and she's bleeding. And the way she was lying there when her son was trying to get into the house to check on her, I thought, oh, she's gone. So I couldn't remember that she had survived.
It looked like, you know, Peter Griffith, you know, Griffin, after he had like fallen out of a plane or something. How they always have, you know, the arms everywhere.
When you're that age, usually just bending over to get a spoon will break your hip. So it was really surprising that she's just walked it off.
Well, I guess that was instrumental to the scene, which comes on later on, where they're at the yard sale and the little girl gets to see her. And
it was a little confusing, though, in a sense, because it seemed like the yard sale was on one side of the street, but the little girl takes the box across the street and sees through the window that this woman is in a bed, being in a convalescent sort of state. And I was trying to figure out why is the yard sale happening over there if the whole story just starts to break down immediately at that point.
I think it was bad pacing there, because it was supposed to show her kind of walking alongside the house and the yard sale was out front. But it was hard to see. It was like, what's exactly going on? But the only real tip off you had to that was that the carer, whether she was a nurse or whatever, was the same person that she saw going in the front door and getting her a stink eye. So
But I think we should backtrack a little bit just to talk about the family. So you've got the situation with the family. They've gone through, the husband and wife exes have gone through a divorce, I think 3 months before, and so you have this broken home. And the two girls, I guess, have got joint custody, go to the father's house on the weekend, and he's moved from his little apartment to a brand new house. And I guess that really sets the scene for them needing to go to this yard sale so that he can get some, I think, dinnerware, crockery or something.
The kids complain that he's living in a divorce home with, you know, where's the IKEA? He's got nothing. There's no decorations. And the house does look really nice. It looks very fancy.
Yeah.
In some ways, I think it was very modern and everything. It didn't really suit him. He just seemed like a kind of
bachelor.
Yeah.
Basketball playing bachelor.
It was a lot of home for a guy who only sees the kids on the weekend. So,
yeah. And I guess, you know, and again, such a trope. Them. Yeah, such a trope. Yeah. It's like Mrs. Doubtfire ready to happen here, you know. The only way you can see his kids is if he dresses up like a woman now.
And so, what were you saying of Kira Sedgwick as well?
Were
saying that that's a kind of
casting.
Typical typecast role for her.
Yeah, a little bit. I mean, she's had some excellent roles, and she's been nominated and awarded quite a few awards and everything. But I always see her either as a widower, divorcee, always very disappointed in the ex-husband and men in general. And she played that role fantastic in this
Except for the dentist, her boyfriend.
Yeah, yeah. But wasn't he from Melrose Place? So taking a little bit of a step up, maybe, you know.
Her ex-husband's a college basketball coach and her boyfriend's a dentist. She's got a nose for income, I think. So
Well, I thought that it was rather rude that he'd done some work on the teenage girl. So that Hannah was the teenager.
Yeah.
And I think you're too young to really get any kind of dental work at that point. And I don't know what he did, if he put in some veneers or something.
But I think it was Invisalign.
He wanted overbite correction. Yeah.
Okay. So, but still, should have been with the father's permission. But anyway.
Yeah. Yeah.
I totally digress. It's not relevant to the Dybbuk box at all.
We're all just kind of outraged here, because we have children.
Well, yeah, I have a guy like I don't. Can we put a pin in the thing about dentist. There was this whole thing about the movie sort of like we're introduced to the kids because the youngest one wants to promote vegetarianism in the school and is kind of like sort of set up to be a socially activist. She really wants to like make the world a better place. So when she becomes under the effects of the thing in this box, it's a big character change for her. So,
I mean, I wasn't buying the vegetarianism thing when she was on the floor with the raw steak in her mouth.
Well, that was the thing. I was like, the house is vegetarian, why was there a steak in the fridge? Yeah. I think that dentist must have snuck it in there.
But I do like her. I think she's a brilliant little actor. I mean, her decline.
Oh, yeah.
Is astounding. And I mean, she goes from being this sweet little girl who's just who's disappointed and wants her parents to get back together again, the sweet little innocent thing, to becoming a demon, I guess.
Yeah.
The girl who played Hannah, wasn't she perfect in a very irritated teenager role?
Oh, she had that down. Yeah.
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 Very, very legit. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. But I think it is interesting when, obviously things start happening to the little girl when she opens up the box, because for some time she can't open it. It's like one of those puzzle boxes and it's difficult for her to prize open. And I think the father has a go at it and he can't manage it. But I think when she opens up that box and finds those objects inside, it's very creepy. But she finds a dead moth. It's a very large moth. It looks like one of those murder hornets, I think.
It did a little bit, yeah. And I felt bad for the dad, because like when suddenly there's a real live moth, the dad instinct is the daughter screaming, kill it, and then everybody turns on him for killing it on the bed or killing it at all. He should have taken it outside,
I thought that was another good kind of typical family situation.
Very realistic. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. But yeah, she finds in there a tooth, which was pretty gross, and which comes back into play later on with the dentist as well.
Which is actually this tooth right here.
Wow.
The tooth that was in the box.
Okay.
Not really. It was in here. Happen to have it handy.
Let's move on. And I can't think of what else she finds in there. It seems like a little skeleton.
There was a bird skeleton. It's cotton, balls of cotton and little containers with desiccated life. Mirror on the lid. Yeah. And the ring. Yeah.
The ring. So, which she takes out and promptly puts on, and then all hell breaks loose, really.
You know, we don't learn much about the ring. I mean, I thought it might have vaguely been reminiscent of the sort of the Ring of Solomon, which was supposed to be able to control demons.
So it wasn't the Ring of Gollum.
It was not the Ring of Gollum.
I thought it looked like one of those kind of sporting rings, you know, that when players on a football team or something get a ring.
A little bit, to me.
Yeah.
Yep. But yeah, I mean, the thing is when we actually do get to see the Dybbuk later, Gollum does come to mind.
Yes, very much so.
Yeah.
Creepy little demon baby kind of a thing. Then is positioned as being a woman from the sound of the voice, which we start to see the presence of the demon, the hand coming out of the little girl's mouth. And when she's munching on fries in a restaurant and she just keeps eating and she's, you know, starving, and that voice comes out of her saying she's still hungry. And that sounds like a woman to me. So it's kind of strange that then the demon's baby like.
It also reminded me of Chris Farley, when he did the skit in the mall where he was supposed to be on a diet and he keeps eating French fries, they tell him to stop. He's like, no, you know.
Well, I like the scene too where she's eating pancakes for breakfast and she just keeps shoving them in her mouth, and the father tells her to slow down and she stabs him. That was
a good surprising. Turning point. Yeah.
That's one of those memorable scenes, though, you know, that make you think, yeah, that was a good movie, because that came out of nowhere. You didn't expect that. And the injury on his hand never really got brought up again, because that
went. It did not. He was remarkably calm for having been stabbed in the hand with a fork. And the fork was hanging out of his hand. He's like, it was like, my gosh, that was peculiar behavior from my daughter. I need to investigate. Nobody cusses in this movie except for the girl at one point in the film. Like, it was remarkably staid performance from the dirty language department. Like, hardly anybody's. I believe the F bombs would have been dropping pretty fast in my house when things started to go south.
Yeah, definitely.
Just the moth, and like nothing supernatural. Just the moth in the bed would have probably got a priest worthy cascade of blasphemy, I think.
Well, I knew I had one around here somewhere.
Yeah, it's not a bent one.
Not yet. But
the times they are changing.
I think that the moth scene. So we should talk a little bit more about that, and that really reminds me of Amityville. With the flies.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
Further to the idea that the director of the film, I can't remember his name. It's
Ole Bornedal. He's a Danish director.
And he says that he was very heavily influenced by The Exorcist. And that scene, I think in particular, it really is very, very strong that he was influenced by it. To see all of those moths, and that is genuinely a creepy scene with the little girl on the bed, and it looks like she's in a trance or something.
Looking in the mirror.
Yeah.
Moths everywhere, and it just seems like an infestation in this new home. Just a bad neighborhood.
Well, and the two things, for metaphor, the moth obviously symbolizes change, you know, going from a caterpillar to, you know, this flying other form. And also the devouring of fabrics. But the other thing is they're constantly using drone shots of top-down views of the neighborhoods and buildings. And it's, I think, in a sense, that's supposed to show us that everybody's in a box all the time. Like, so you're constantly dealing with these boxes as the film progresses.
At this, Blake. That's some good analysis there, because I didn't really...
Wow, you should be part of a show... Yeah,
talking
where we
about
actually
things like
break
this.
Down things. Yeah, that would be awesome. You'd do good at that. Yeah, you know, it's that was one of the things. Matasheu, is that the artist, the musician that played I don't know if he was a rabbi yet or in training.
He was the son of a rabbi. And then he was also in real life. He is that, as he said, these curls are real. And one of the little bonus features. He is a Hasidic Jew.
Not a costume. So he was,
not a costume. Yeah, he's not acting.
Have you listened to any of his music? I have not. It's very, it's kind of like Bob Marley, but a little less reggae.
That's pretty cool. And I thought, yeah, he played that role very well. He came across as just very gentle and very concerned. I guess we're leaping ahead at this point to the point where they're requiring an exorcism. And the rest of the community are just kind of turning their backs and on the father and the little girl and saying it's left up to God to decide what's going to happen.
Yeah, but as the daughter, I mean, because I think the plot is sort of dealing with the idea of, is she really possessed or is she just reacting to the divorce that's going on? Of course, as the audience, we're seeing a very explicit, clear indications that there's something supernatural going on. So it sort of creates that dramatic irony of we know something that the rest of the people don't.
Oh, yeah, yeah. It really comes across as she's just unhappy because of the broken home situation. And at the same time, as though the father's turned violent. And there's that one scene where something slaps her. And from the perspective of the teenager, it looks like the father's slapping the little girl around. And, and yeah, everyone, as you say, dramatic irony. We're seeing
and I don't
everything.
I don't want to throw away the fact that at school she begins to act out. Attacks one other student because the kid decides to steal her bag, which has she snuck the Dybbuk box into the school.
You know, like great you do. Big duffel bag. Yeah,
very that was
really
normal.
Sneaky.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
But then
that was
who gets punished for this? The teacher gets killed. I think she's our first on screen death. And like she did nothing to deserve that death, you know?
Yeah. And I think she confiscated the box and she was the one who said, I think if she spends some time away from the box, that will be for the best.
But dad goes and throws it in a dumpster.
Well, that's the thing. And that's one of those plot holes that Matt has talked about. Why is it that the father wasn't killed? You know, why is it that the Jew is killed towards the end and that this teacher is killed? All of these, to some extent, innocence. And yet the parents aren't killed. And so many times, too, the scene that Matt referred to earlier with the little girl with the meat in her mouth and just destroying the kitchen. I mean, at that point, she was holding a shard of glass and she could have killed the mother. And why did she not?
Well, there was a lot of really over-the-top vulgar displays of power. But it didn't seem like they had purpose. Because every time you would expect that to come out and, you know, take care of things, it didn't. It only happened in these kind of jump scare moments. And so that was disappointing. But I also want to say about the whole slapping thing is, you know, if you watch that, you can see the marks on her face. Oh. And that was a total nod to The Exorcist again.
Okay. I thought
that to be a bit of a homage. To The Exorcist,
nod to The Exorcist was the MRI scene where little girl's having all of these tests to see what's wrong with her from a psychiatric point of view. And I have to say, having had an MRI, it's not exactly like that. Perhaps it might be in some instances, but I did think that was very creepy when, I mean, you wouldn't have the whole family in the room watching as this is taking place, you know.
You would not.
But I did think it was creepy to see this face appear right next to the little girl's heart with the MRI results.
It's a great effect. But terrifying. As you say, the MRI does slices and then they reconstruct them in the computer. It's not a live view.
It's
not an instant
thing.
Right.
But it was a super creepy idea to have literally to be
effective.
Able to see the demon. Yeah.
Well, and
but the demon knew where to look too. So it looked like from the screen.
It was certainly a plot device so that the mother would start believing in what was happening and that it wasn't the father's involvement. It's real.
Absolutely. What about the mask that she had to wear to hold her head down? Is that something they do more for children, you think? Because
I've never seen that before.
But I want a Halloween costume that has that.
I think she would be sedated. I don't think that they just would have put her through that, and they do have a little thing to position your head and often a pillow, and they usually give you earplugs as well. So again, I think
it's very loud.
Extremely loud. And it is very much like The Exorcist, where they're just subjecting her to these torture-like tests. And I think just to kind of instill that extra fear in you that, oh, this poor little girl undergoing all of this, and she's suffering so much.
Well, it's kind of like the Rabbi Sun says, I don't like hospitals.
Yeah,
I think
we all get that feeling, you know, that we don't like this hospital.
Well, little did he know he was on his way to his own death shortly thereafter.
Yeah, that's spoilers. True. Another
well, it was all about spoilers.
I love the fact. Okay, so we're alluding to the fact that this this son of a rabbi comes to help, but we sort of left out the part. We left out the part with how did he get involved, which is the father figures out by talking to another expert at the college where he's a basketball coach at college. He goes to a religious studies guy, and that guy says, this is the word for a Jewish demon. And this is a box designed to keep one inside. And, you know, and when he realizes that he needs help, he jumps in his car and drives to the closest, I guess, place he can think of where he'll find lots of Jewish people. He finds a rabbi in New York City. So I thought that's a little stereotypical. I mean, they probably also have rabbis in Rochester, you know, like you don't necessarily have to go down to New York City, but it was very cool to see that. I mean,
pretty
New York and Hollywood, that's the only places they are.
Yeah.
So
I couldn't quite tell where he was going too, if it was Albany or exactly where he was going.
Yeah. Yeah. So he went down to New York City. There's a large Hasidic Jewish community there. And he went and talked to some rabbi, and I love their hats. They're wearing, I don't know what those are called, but I think of it as the big Russian Orthodox type fur hats.
Yeah.
And he went,
I think he meant the skull cap. So,
the yarmulkes. Cool. Yeah. I love the idea of bringing in, this would be the scene. If this was a sort of a Christian movie, it would be the scene where you go get the Catholic priest, you know, so we're getting a rabbi instead. And I love the idea of like matching your spiritual protection to the sort of origin of the demon. So, you know, that's kind of cool.
I think it is cool to see those differences. And I think that there's just something a little bit more creepy about these Orthodox Jews performing an exorcism as opposed to a priest. I think just in terms of what we're familiar with, we're so used to seeing Catholic exorcisms, and that's the stereotype. So this
when you say creepy, do you mean just exotic? Like it's because it's just not as often depicted?
I think, it's not you know what we're familiar with. We're familiar with the whole exorcist idea with the purple
stole,
and just that is kind of the stereotype for seeing an exorcism. So to see it this way, I think just added an element of being different and not knowing what to expect.
Would also universality.
What?
Go ahead. I was going to say, it added to the universality of demonic possession that like maybe every religion has some kind of demons how to deal with them. Yeah. Which is pretty true. Yeah.
A lot of people don't think that we don't think of that outside of our own experience or what we're familiar with. And
yeah, it was a very interesting thing to watch that. And the rabbi who's going to be doing the exorcism it's the same as a Catholic priest, is they are a representative of God, and they're assuming basically God's power to say get out of here, you know, you don't belong here, demon. And so it's kind of strange when they're like just leave it up to God.
Yeah,
you know, it's like,
yeah,
aren't you supposed to go and represent God, you know?
I thought it was interesting, the scene where the father attempts an exorcism and he goes to see the little girl. I think she's homesick from school that day, and the other daughter is heading off to school. And he sits on her bed and starts reading from the Torah. And pretty quickly, I think she turns her head to look at him and just gives him the stink eye, as Matt said earlier. The book flies across the room.
It was a terrible experience.
Yeah. So. But it was amusing to see that, just how pathetic his attempt was. And
it was,
this power was much stronger than him.
Yeah, and again, that was another one of those displays of power that could have been used in other ways. But anyway, she could close the door before he came in the room, maybe. I don't know.
What about the exorcism itself? So I think that they're down in the morgue, aren't they? They
go to the physical therapy place first, which he knew from basketball, and then from there the at one point the demon escapes the room and goes to the morgue, which for some reason is full of dead bodies and no refrigeration. That was very weird.
That's like, exactly what I said to Matt.
Was there some weird tragedy where it was like 30 corpses and no AC? It was
I wonder if the room itself might have been
a big refrigerator.
But even still, that wasn't typical.
I don't know. Yeah, it seemed a little strange.
Yeah, but it was whole DOA tags and everything.
Yeah.
But I think that certainly added to the creepy factor that they're in a morgue, and I think it was kind of foreshadowing what was going to happen too.
Well, it kind of made you feel like you had to be on guard for these dead bodies to do something, you know, hop up and dance Thriller or something. Because, you know, why did they need to be there other than it was just kind of a low level creep factor? So,
well, that, and it was a really familiar spot for our main character, Jeffrey Dean, because he's used to Morgan.
Yeah.
Okay.
Was it really?
It was not. It was not. Like those dead bodies, it's a stinker. Sorry.
Oh, boy. But I did think that the exorcism itself was a little kind of wishy-washy, really. You know, it didn't last terribly long. And demon very quickly transfers from the little girl into the father who's screaming, take me.
Who kept saying over and over again, I guess that he had definitely seen The Exorcist because he was saying, take me.
Yeah.
I was like, okay.
Definitely a nod to that.
But then that seemed pointless. You know, like in The Exorcist, take me. Okay, now you're in my body. I've got a little bit of control left. I'm going to jump out the window and take you with me. Okay, I've got you now. I'm going to fall asleep.
Our bodies come in different shapes and sizes. So doesn't it make sense that our weight loss plans should too? That's the beauty of Noom. They build a personal plan that factors in dietary restrictions, medical issues, and other personal needs so your plan works for you. Noom doesn't restrict or shame when you want to treat yourself. Their flexible program focuses on progress instead of perfection. You don't have to give up carbs or anything. And with their daily lessons, you can learn something new about your food choices every day. After just a few days of using the app, I learned how to recognize cues for overeating and how to choose the right foods to feel full. Stay focused on what's important to you with Noom's psychology and biology-based approach. Sign up for your trial today at Noom.com. That's Noom.com. And check out Noom's first ever cookbook, The Noom Kitchen, for 100 healthy and delicious recipes to promote better living. Available to buy now wherever books are sold.
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
Yeah. He kind of slumped over and, eyes rolled back into his head. And
Dybbuk could be a little bit like, okay, I am going to choose this moment to jump into your body because you're bigger, you're stronger, and I can utilize that in some way. Mm-hmm. But I've got this downtime, you know, of 20 minutes or so before I can actually do anything. Is this a good time to make the jump? And the demon didn't plan ahead, I think, in this sense, and didn't think about that downtime because gave them plenty of time to finish the exorcism.
Yeah. Well, the first time we see the possession, we see all the moths flying into the little girl sort of exhibiting. And like, but in between when it jumped from the little girl to the dad, we didn't see any of that transfer. It just happened off screen.
Yeah, well, there was a couple. He had some moths flying in, didn't he? Or were they flying out?
Maybe I didn't see him. They flew out.
Yeah, I think to show that he was possessed. But yeah, the whole thing, I think him being possessed and then this demon leaving him was kind of without incident. And you hear of a lot of stories, anecdotes when it comes to exorcisms with the kinds of things that happen. You'll hear a shotgun or something else like that when the demon leaves. But this one just kind of slunk away back into the box and that was it.
So they put it in the box, they close it up, they throw a prayer cloth over it, and our loads it into Jeffrey Dean Morgan's car, which Jeffrey Dean Morgan says, you could just keep the car, I'm staying here.
keep it. Like, yeah, and I don't.
That's
need
not actually how lies. Car transfers work. That's not a thing. But yeah, it all worked out.
It was
out
pretty okay. Nice car for a coach too. But I wanted to say we've got to talk about the Dybbuk's name. How kind of like Rapunzel, they needed to discover the name of the daemon, and that was I think Abizu, which meant taker of children.
It's a handy word to have in your vocab. So
quite yeah. Creepy. Yeah. I mean, from the first scene, anyway. Yeah, maybe. Maybe that's a thing, but it seemed to have a focus on children rather than adults.
Yeah. Well, although it started in an old lady and spent some time at Jeffrey Dean Morgan, so.
Yep.
Yeah. And it didn't get rid of any of them, but.
But again, anyway. Here, this box is supposed to house the Dybbuk. It's supposed to keep it under control. It's supposed to keep it from doing anything. Again, we have a vulgar display of power at the end when it's in the Dybbuk box and under control and under a prayer.
True. That's a good point.
So yeah. I don't understand how the Dybbuk managed to have a semi truck hit the car and have the car obvious, you know, have the rabbi's son not paying attention. The whole thing just kind of seems strange.
Like, wasn't there a scene in either The Poltergeist or Amityville where someone was injured in a car?
Yeah, I think
priest.
We had the priest. We had the vomiting nun in Amityville.
Okay.
In the original, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
He was sick and then he was in a car accident. There was all kinds of stuff that happened to him to keep him from coming back to help clear the house. Yeah.
That's right. Yeah. Yeah. But like I think we've probably spent long enough talking about the movie and the plot. We should start talking about the true story.
Well, I mean, obviously this story is so incredible and, you know, people died and it was very, as you say, so many vulgar displays of power. There should be lots of documentation for the true story then, I guess.
Mm-hmm. So yeah. You want to lay it on us?
This is one of those cases that when it first came out, like that when it first hit the world as a paranormal story, I was fascinated because it sounded like a scheme to sell something on eBay.
Exactly.
It's what it sounded like. Mm-hmm. In fact, we should probably expound on what the claims are before we get into what actually happened.
Right around the time that a lot of things were being sold on eBay, on Etsy, haunted items. So this was really in keeping with that kind of, you know, belief and story. But I get a little confused because you've got a number of players in this story. There's Kevin Manis and there is Jason Haxton. And I get a little confused as to who kind of kickstarted all of this because I don't know that there was a website and then there was the Dybbuk box which was being sold on eBay and just a lot of people telling stories and then kind of backtracking. So I think it gets a little confusing from this point. Suffice to say, it's not true.
Well, I think it was Kevin Manis that really snowballed this into something ridiculous, matzo balled it into something ridiculous, I guess, if you will. It was around 2001. And, you know, he claims he went to he wanted to get this little wine cabinet as an odd gift for his mother. You know, the story goes that his father used to get his mother a plaid dress every year for her birthday and without fail. And the thing was, is she hated plaid. So he would give that to her and then she could take it back to the store and get whatever she wanted. And that just made it easy for him. So it kind of started a tradition of getting strange gifts. So he saw this this wine cabinet and decided that it would be the perfect gift for his mother.
Mm-hmm. Well, I should say what they found inside of this. So it was a little different. It wasn't a tooth. It wasn't a dead bird or moths or anything like that. So we didn't go back to talking about the dentist either. You reminded me. So inside this wine cabinet, there were two locks of hair. There was a granite slab, I think, with some Hebrew written on it. There was a dried rosebud and a goblet and two wheat pennies. I don't know what a wheat penny is.
Pennies on the backside, instead of the Lincoln Memorial, they have two wheat, like stalks of wheat coming together.
Oh, okay, yes. Very, very Jewish.
Wheat.
Yep.
Wheat.
So a candlestick as well and a Dybbuk.
Yeah.
That was, yeah, the unexpected thing that was in there. But we saw the mother recounting the story on TV. I can't remember what the name of the show was. It was a paranormal...
Paranormal
stories. Yeah. Kind of show. And she was retelling the story. And I mean, she truly believed in it. And it appeared as she was speaking as though she'd had a stroke. And that was the case. And the way they positioned it was as though he presented this gift to her, the son, and then he walked away. And as she's looking at it, she experienced a stroke. And she was unable to speak and unable to communicate with him and with the son. And finally he came back in the room and called for an ambulance. But she was very firmly placing blame on this box, that is what had caused her stroke. And so I don't know what the correlation is between when that took place, but she certainly presented it and he presented it as though the box had caused her stroke.
Right. When she was trying to become verbal again, she was writing messages to him saying, like, bad gift, you know, like the effective message was, do not want this is bad. Don't
get
want
rid of
no
it.
Good. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I can't exchange this for whatever I want.
Right. Right.
You miss
the plaid dress. Jacket. Thank you. Right. Yeah.
Right.
But then we have other people, too. I mean, what I find is strange, and I think it was the other fellow, was it Jason Haxton, who'd had the Dybbuk box, who purchased it at another point, and he'd had it for about 2 decades and talked about all of these terrible things that had happened to him. Why wouldn't you get rid of the bloody thing in that period of time?
Because he was blogging about it and writing a book about it. Exactly.
But, I mean, if you truly felt that this thing was evil, you would get rid of it. You wouldn't keep it.
A lot of people stay in troubled relationships for reasons that are really hard to explain.
With boxes, yeah.
It's complicated. It's complicated.
But it's interesting to see now, if you go and Google Dybbuk boxes, there are so many of them for sale, and people actually recreating very beautiful versions and selling them. But they're still pretty popular, and yet it seems as though, I guess, to get to the crux of it, that Dybbuks are a thing in terms of belief in Jewish tradition and folklore, but a Dybbuk box is not.
Is not, exactly.
Yeah, it was created by Manus, Kevin Manus.
Yes.
And that's a really interesting thing for him to come out and talk about. It's
rare. It's funny. I like it.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I mean, the thing that's funny is, one interviewer called him up and he was, like admitting the whole thing to him. And then when the interviewer started hitting him with some tougher questions about it, he started kind of waffling and going back on some of his story. It's a little bit like the Fox sisters.
It's exactly what I was thinking.
We're completely
true. It's not. Yeah,
exactly. And it did finally, then he got a hold of the interviewer again, said, okay, I'm ready for all the hard questions, go ahead. And it was a little bit like he was trying to get the interviewer to kind of beat it out of him. He wanted to let the demon go.
Want to be free of the lie. I mean, it is a burden to keep having to tell the same story. It is.
What offends me with this story is that he was linking the box to a previous owner, a Polish woman who had been, who was a Holocaust survivor. So I think capitalizing on that kind of story is the real evil here. That's
right.
A horrible thing to do.
It gets a little crazy because he says she was trying to summon some magical force to help conquer Hitler, and it went wrong. And so what she summoned had to be trapped in the box to protect everybody. And that since she'd done this, many horrible things had happened, World War II, Korea, all these different, like the Vietnam War, all these things are attributable to the mistake of letting this thing out.
But then when you hear about the other stories that these owners talk about, it's things like nightmares, and I had some bad luck. I had some had some misfortune. So a little bit different.
My kick fell.
The team was canceled.
Yeah.
But there is an episode of The Twilight Zone where a man has trapped the devil. And while the devil's trapped, it helps keep evil out of the world. And he had to track the devil down because he had actually, it's called The Howling Man. It's a really fun story, but it's by Charles Beaumont. And he had he had found the devil captured and accidentally gets tricked into releasing him, and then has spent many years hunting him down and capturing again. And now he's got him and everything's going to be okay. And then in the end, somebody lets him out again because the devil's very tricky. But the whole point being that all the perils and evils of the world are caused by Satan running loose is very simplistic, very widely believed, and in my opinion, a cop out. So yeah,
for sure.
Well, I was going to talk a little bit about the ad that the eBay listing.
Oh, sure, yes.
And yeah. I mean, it was the eBay listing was so long and detailed and everything else that it, you know, some people calling the Dybbuk box an urban legend, and it doesn't quite fit that because it's it is so mapped out, and it's not so much, oh, my, you know, cousin's daughter's neighbor,
right,
you know,
right,
so it's not really an urban legend, it's just a work of fiction. And this guy wrote a beautiful fiction for this eBay posting, and it was, you know, to any person that's of that mindset, very convincing. You know, he covered all the bases very well. And of course, you know, prices started going up, not as much as I would expect it. I would have thought the price would have gotten higher.
Well, yeah, you can.
We do know that you
tens
know,
of thousands of dollars for a you know, Jesus on toast. A cheese sandwich. Yeah. And this only went for, I think, about $200. I think initially it went for 100 and something. Mm-hmm. And the second time around, it was 230,
I think. Yeah.
Yeah. Not that much. And where is it now?
Oh, you want to do that now?
The Dybbuk box now? Well, yeah. Unless you've got anything more to say, because I was going to go into the confession.
No, there was a particular guy that we discussed on our Haunted Objects Monster Talk Live that has one of these museums by the name of Zach
Bagans.
Yeah, Bagans.
Bagans.
I have tea Bagans. Bagans. Scooby Douche, whatever you want to call him. He purchased this for an undisclosed amount. And
yeah, I'd like to know how much he paid.
Yeah, yeah. But he has it's in his little museum, making money for mm-hmm. him there. But he is really pushing hard the idea that this is the most haunted object on Earth. And so much so that a lot of people are taking that for granted, that it is the most haunted object on Earth. Although we know for a fact that Zach has never exaggerated or faked anything in his entire career.
Well, I've got a quote here. So I think it was earlier on during the pandemic where he and some of his cohorts stayed in the museum for a couple of weeks doing some, you know, quarantining themselves. And so it doesn't sound like a publicity stunt or anything like that. And during this time, they opened the box. So here's a quote from Zach. So they opened the box, and the scariest moment for me is what I saw and felt. We captured on camera an unbelievable mist coming out of the box that manifested eyes. The lead investigator also believes he saw the Dybbuk entity crouching down towards the wall behind the box. So, I mean, truly, if this thing was capable, but if it was capable of all of these things, as in the movie, as in the stories, the narratives, you'd be getting the hell out of there, wouldn't you?
This thing was going to stop Hitler.
Yeah. They didn't show that effect in the film, and that seems like a missed opportunity.
Well, I don't know. You can see a little bit here.
Yes, yeah.
No, a missed opportunity.
Oh, yeah.
No, I heard you. I was just okay. ignoring you.
Yeah.
No, the thing is yeah, that was the night Post Malone was there, correct? That was the big
right, that's right.
Oh, yeah, the
cursing
rocker,
of Post Malone. And lots he never actually touched it. He never actually touched it. So
and now his face is covered in tattoos. How can science explain this?
Yeah, he said yes, some of his experiences, I think it was in that kind of he had some bad luck, you know, he
IBS.
Lost some money on the horse or something. I don't know. But yeah, well, wasn't anything very serious. But I think that the most interesting part of all of this is that all the things that Zach has said, I think he's said somewhere else that the box is not yet finished. that there's a lot more that it's going to do to accomplish whatever.
Yeah, but that was in response to them saying, oh, did you not hear that this was all a hoax?
That's exactly where I'm going. So Manus wrote a Facebook post. This is October 24th, 2015. He said, I am the original creator of the story of the Dybbuk box, which appeared as one of my eBay posts back in 2003. The idea that Dybbuk boxes have some kind of history prior to my story, and the idea that a Dybbuk box could contain anything other than a Dybbuk, along with any deviation to the type of contents I created to be found inside of a Dybbuk box, is laughable at best. How about this? If you or anyone else can find any reference to a Dybbuk box, so sick, in history prior to my eBay post, I'll pay you $100,000 and tattoo your name on my forehead.
And yet it seems to be Post Malone that tattooed something on his forehead. So
it's true. But
it has done nothing, I think, to alleviate the fear and belief that a lot of people have in this whole idea.
They've done two things here. They've basically said that because he did this. Now, he claims he is such a devout Jew that, you know, and he studied the Kabbalah and everything else, and he's so devout. Then why did he create this big lie? If that's the case,
box.
Yeah, the Dybbuk box. You know, he created this huge lie, and it's steamrolling forward still. But they're saying because he did that, he actually cursed the box by doing it. There's that aspect, or there's the idea that thought forms are a real thing, and everybody believes that. Yeah, exactly. Now you can't deny it, Blake, because, you know, enough people believed in it. Now it is cursed.
I'll say this. The Black Eyed Kids, same thing. One guy writes a very fascinating and spooky internet story.
Internet,
and then what
legends,
happens?
Yeah.
Everybody starts writing their own. And then it happened to me. Yeah. The little Black Eyed Kid showed up. It's the same thing. And what he's done,
no,
and I don't
on,
believe
put,
in.
Put the brakes on, Blake. I'm going to stop you right here because, we were going to record yesterday this show. Why didn't we?
I got cursed.
Yeah. Yep, with a sore throat.
Yeah, I guess I had a sore throat. And how can science explain this?
But then we resumed
you see
it
this?
Today. So
you see this?
Yeah.
I do.
Is that a power band?
Yeah. I wish that would be awesome. Anyway, I was blocking bullets and I got shot in the arm. No, I was cleaning the basement and I managed to fall up the stairs. Answer that one, science. I fell up the stairs and I got a gash on my arm. Son, that's all because we're doing this show.
So, but so I don't believe there's a supernatural element, but I do believe that stories in our minds take on a life of their own. And that whole,
absolutely,
like you see people sharing things on the internet and then some people can't leave it at that. They have to put their own little twist on it and they, you know, that you can call it memes or whatever you want, but people love to share stories and make themselves a part of it and keep these legends alive.
It's a communal reinforcement as well.
It is. It absolutely is. And so he's brought something to life. I don't think it's demonic, but it's certainly narrative. So
absolutely. Well said. Yeah. Well, I think on that note, there's not really much more to say about this. I mean, it's a hoax, but it exists as a thing for cultural reasons, and it's a movie. And I think it's a pretty fair movie. Blake, you didn't like it very much?
I didn't, but, you know, it was very pretty. It was easy to watch. So, you know, you won't hurt your eyes. Yeah. So it wasn't to my taste, but then I have terrible taste. I mean, look at me. I didn't like this beautiful movie, but I love Italian horror from the 70s. Who could explain this? I don't know. So
science, try to explain that one.
More bad luck.
The curse continues.
So, but thank you for joining us for this discussion, everybody.
Yes. Yes. Yeah,
it was fun to talk about. I do want to say really quickly that the story is ongoing. And the reason it is because Kevin Manus and Haxton are basically having a little bit of a feud and don't seem to like each other. Now Haxton is the one
the Highgate Vampire all over again. This is great.
These things happen. Yeah.
And you know, Haxton is the one who wrote the book and sold the rights for the movie and made the lion's share of the money off of the whole thing. And so he's claiming, oh, he's just jealous of me. He's just jealous. And then you've got Manus going, I'm not jealous. Oh, and I did want to also say the mother's performance on, was it Paranormal Witness, was also fake. She did not believe in the Dybbuk box either. And that was all made up on the spot by her. She faked that whole thing.
She came
well.
Across as so sincere. Mm-hmm. That's really, I mean, TV studios.
You never know where those improv skills are going to pop up. What?
Yeah. But yeah, I mean, he said that was fraud. A gift from his mother that she did that.
Tangled web.
Yeah. Wow. But the best thing about that original Dybbuk box was the way it opened. When you pull out that drawer and the doors open, I mean, it was so graceful and attractive. It felt like something was opening those doors on you. And I think the one in the movie wasn't as cool, other than the fact that it was a puzzle box. But
it looked like a stick someone had kind of whittled. wasn't as impressive.
But
wind it up.
Is there anything that this movie could have done to make it better for you, Blake?
I think if I'd had some a Passover wine to go with it, it would have probably helped.
Yeah. Right. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Fair enough. Yeah. Yeah. Fair enough.
Monster Talk.
You've been listening to Monster Talk, the science show about monsters. I'm Blake Smith.
And I'm Karen Stolzner.
You just heard an audio-only presentation from our YouTube series, Debased on a True Story, covering the 2012 film, The Possession. A link to the video, as well as to the movie and other research materials, are in our show notes. You can enjoy extended commercial-free versions of this show by joining us at patreon.com/monstertalk, all one word, MONSTERTALK. For as little as $2 a month, you can enjoy longer interviews, unbleeped language, and bonus episodes exclusive for patrons. And if $2 a month is not workable for you, but you still want to help out, be sure and leave us a positive review on your podcasting platform of choice. iTunes reviews in particular can help bring in new listeners, and your positive reviews really make a difference. If you want to learn other ways to help out, visit monstertalk.org/support, where you can find even more ways to help keep this show going. Thank you to all of you who are supporting us with your hard-earned money and valuable time. We are humbled and grateful and hope that we always live up to or even exceed your expectations. Monster Talk theme music is by Peach Stealing Monkeys, and we appreciate your making our humble show a part of your complicated life. Thanks.
In a Monster House presentation.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.